All right, get ready, because we're going to take a deep dive into a case that really shook things up when it comes to capital punishment in the U.S., Atkins v. Virginia. And you've given me just a ton of material here to go through, trial transcripts and expert opinions, and it's just so clear that this case is about way more than just one man, right?
It really is. What I think is just so interesting about Atkins v. Virginia is how it makes us confront, the fact that society's values change over time and how that affects the law. We're talking about some really big concepts here, like the Eighth Amendment, intellectual disability, and at the end of the day, who should face the death penalty?
No, absolutely. So let's start with the human side of this story. We're talking about Daryl Renard Atkins, convicted in Virginia for a truly horrific crime, abduction, armed robbery, and it ended in the murder of Eric Nesbitt.
Yeah, and the details of that crime, they're actually outlined in the trial transcripts he provided, and it's chilling. Atkins and the guy he was with, they didn't just rob Eric Nesbitt. They forced him to take money out of an ATM and then they shot him like 8 times. And, that level of brutality, it's really important to understand why the prosecution was pushing so hard for the death penalty.
Yeah, no, after reading through those transcripts, it's easy to see why a jury would come back and say, Atkins deserves the most severe punishment possible. But this is where things get really interesting. During the sentencing phase of the trial, a forensic psychologist testified that Atkins had an IQ of 59.
Right. And that score at the time, it put Adkins in the mildly mentally retarded category, which was, the accepted term back then. But of course, now we use intellectually disabled, which is, more respectful and accurate.
Right. And this diagnosis, it becomes the central point of the entire legal battle, right?
Absolutely. The defense basically said, look, if you execute someone with an intellectual disability, that's cruel and unusual punishment, and that's forbidden by the Eighth Amendment.
So even though the crime was so brutal, Atkins's intellectual capacity, that throws a wrench in the whole thing.
Exactly. And this isn't just some like theoretical legal argument. It really makes you think about culpability. If someone doesn't fully understand the consequences of what they're doing, can you really hold them accountable in the same way?
Okay, so you've got this trial, this low IQ score comes out. And what happens next? I mean, does the jury consider that?
They don't, and it's kind of surprising. Atkins is sentenced to death, but here's a twist. The Virginia Supreme Court actually overturns the sentence, and they order a second sentencing hearing because there was something wrong with the original verdict form.
Interesting. A second chance. Did anything change at this new sentencing?
Well, this is where what's often called the battle of the experts really heats up. The prosecution brings in their own expert. And this expert, after evaluating Atkins, testifies that he's actually of average intelligence, and they actually diagnose him with antisocial personality disorder.
Hold on, wait. So we have two experts saying totally opposite things about Atkins' mental state. One says intellectually disabled, the other average intelligence. How is that even possible?
It shows, one of the most challenging things about cases like this, defining and measuring intellectual disability, it's not like an exact science. Different experts might use different tools, they might interpret the data differently, or they might even have different theoretical perspectives.
So in a way, it comes down to whose expert the jury believes more.
Yeah, pretty much. And this time, the jury sides with the prosecution's expert. So Atkins is sentenced to death again. And then this decision is upheld by the Virginia Supreme Court. But of course, the defense, they're not done. They appeal all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court.
And this is where things get really interesting, right? Because now the Supreme Court, they're not just deciding one man's fate. They're looking at a question that could change things for a lot of future cases.
You got it. The Supreme Court takes this case because they want to answer a really big question. Is it against the Eighth Amendment to execute someone with an intellectual disability? Is that cruel and unusual punishment? And their decision in Atkins v. Virginia, it really sends shockwaves through the legal system.
Okay, so let's unpack the Supreme Court's reasoning. What were the main points that led them to overturn Atkins' death sentence?
Okay, to understand how they got there, we need to look at the two-pronged approach that the majority opinion laid out. It's a framework that becomes like a landmark in how we think about intellectual disability and the death penalty. So the first prong, it really focuses on this idea of a national consensus. Basically, the court, they wanted to see if there was a general agreement across the country. Was it morally and legally wrong to execute people with intellectual disabilities?
So they looked at things like state laws, court decisions. They were trying to figure out where the nation stood on this.
Right, exactly. And what they found was really significant. They saw that more and more states were passing laws that said you can't execute someone with an intellectual disability. And to the majority of the justices, this showed what they called an evolving standard of decency. Society's views on this were changing.
It's interesting how they used this idea of evolving standards. to look at the Eighth Amendment in a new way. You know, a document that was written centuries ago. It's like they're saying our understanding of what cruel and unusual means can change over time.
Exactly. They said the Eighth Amendment has to be interpreted in light of how we see things today, how society's norms are evolving.
Okay, so that's one prong, a shift in societal views. What's the second part of their reasoning?
The second prong, it really gets into the goals of the death penalty. Why do we have it? Deterrence and retribution. So the court looked at whether these justifications, you know, did they really make sense when you're talking about people with intellectual disabilities?
Right, right. So just to refresh my memory, deterrence means preventing future crime, and retribution means making the punishment fit the crime, right?
Yeah, that's it. And the court basically said, look, these reasons, they're not as strong when we're talking about people with intellectual disabilities. You know, because of their cognitive limitations, they're not as culpable, meaning they might not understand the consequences of their actions as well. So they're less likely to be deterred.
So it makes you think, if someone doesn't really get the seriousness of what they did, can we justify executing them, either as punishment or to deter others? It seems like the court was really wrestling with some big ethical questions here.
Oh, absolutely. And it's important to point out that the court didn't say you can never execute someone with an intellectual disability. They made a distinction between these categorical bans and what they call individualized sentencing.
So they weren't saying intellectual disability automatically gets someone off death row.
Right. They said states can still consider intellectual disability as a reason to maybe give someone a less severe sentence. So allowed for these case-by-case assessments.
Yeah, that makes sense. It gives some flexibility while still protecting people who are more vulnerable.
Now, even though this two-pronged approach was kind of groundbreaking, it wasn't like everyone agreed. Some of the justices who disagreed with the majority in Atkins, they had some really strong objections. Justice Scalia's dissent, it was particularly harsh.
What was his main problem with the majority opinion?
Scalia, he was a big believer in sticking to the original meaning of the Constitution, what's called a textualist. And he thought this whole idea of evolving standards of decency, it gave the court too much power. Like, they could basically rewrite the Constitution based on what people were thinking at the time.
So he thought they were overstepping their role, imposing their own morals.
Exactly. He even said they were cherry-picking data, you know, just using the data that supported their conclusion about a national consensus against executing people with intellectual disabilities.
That's a pretty serious accusation. Were there any other important dissenting opinions?
Yes. Chief Justice Rehnquist, he agreed with Scalia about the court maybe having too much power. And he also brought up the idea of federalism.
Right, federalism. That's the balance of power between the federal government and the state government.
Exactly. Rehnquist basically said this decision was stepping on the state's toes, you know, interfering with their right to make their own laws about criminal justice. He was worried that it set a bad precedent, the federal government getting too involved in matters that should be left to the states.
Wow. So you have these really fundamental clashes over the role of the court, how to interpret the Constitution, the balance of power in the government. It's amazing how one case can cause so much debate.
Absolutely. And, you know, to really understand the impact of Atkins, we need to compare it to an earlier case the Supreme Court decided, Penry v. Lanaw, back in 1989.
Okay, what happened in Penry? Was it similar?
Yeah, it also involved the execution of someone with an intellectual disability. But in Penry, the court said it was okay. They upheld the constitutionality of doing that.
Wait, so in Penry, they said it was fine. But then just like a decade later in Atkins, they completely reversed course.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable. And it really shows that constitutional law, it's not set in stone. It changes as we learn more about fundamental rights and as society's values shift.
It really makes you appreciate how dynamic the law can be, especially when you're talking about something like the death penalty. So the Supreme Court makes this big decision in Atkins. What happens next? How does this actually play out?
Well, that's where things get even more complex. As you might imagine, taking such a big decision and putting it into practice, it wasn't easy at all. Trying to implement Atkins created a whole bunch of new challenges for the courts.
Okay, so let's dig into those challenges. What were some of the main hurdles that came up when states tried to apply this Atkins ruling? So the Supreme Court basically rewrites the rules about intellectual disability and the death penalty. But then they leave it up to the states to figure out the details. That sounds like a recipe for chaos, right?
Yeah, you're right. One of the biggest problems was, well, there was no clear definition of what intellectual disability actually means. The court said it's unconstitutional to execute people with intellectual disabilities. But they didn't say exactly what that means.
So it's like a landmark decision, but also kind of vague, right? A lot of room for different interpretations.
Exactly. And because of that, different states ended up with different standards. So what might protect someone from the death penalty in one state might not be enough in another state.
That sounds like it would lead to a ton of appeals and legal battles.
It definitely did. And then on top of that, you have this thing called the Flynn effect. And courts had to figure out how to deal with that too.
Oh, right, the Flynn effect. Remind me what that is again?
Sure, it's this trend where IQ scores have been going up over time. Basically, we've gotten better at taking IQ tests. So someone who might have scored below the threshold for intellectual disability, you know, years ago, they might score higher today, even if their actual abilities haven't changed.
Wow, that really complicates things, especially when you're trying to apply the Atkins ruling to Dielder cases. I mean, imagine you're on death row, and because of this Flynn effect, your old IQ score suddenly puts you above the cutoff. What happens then?
That's the exact kind of problem courts were facing, and there's no easy answer. Some people said you have to use the IQ score from the time of the crime, while others said you should use today's standards. It brings up some really tough questions about what's fair and consistent.
It shows how these legal concepts could be tricky, right? Even an IQ score, which seems pretty objective, can be affected by things we might not even consider.
Absolutely. And there's another issue in the Atkins case that we haven't talked about yet, allegations of prosecutorial misconduct.
Wait, there's more. What kind of misconduct?
There were claims that the prosecution had hidden evidence that might have helped Atkins' intellectual disability claim, so that raised serious questions about whether he had a fair trial in the first place.
So even after the Supreme Court ruling, there was still doubt about Atkins' case.
Yes, and here's where it gets interesting. Instead of ordering a new trial, the judge in Atkins' case decided to change his sentence to life in prison.
So no death penalty. But he was still in prison.
Right. The judge basically said the risk of executing the wrong person was just too high, given all the questions about his case.
What a crazy story. It's like this case just kept taking these twists and turns, and every step of the way there were new complications.
It really did, and it's not just about Atkins himself. This case had a huge impact on the legal system, changing how lawyers deal with intellectual disability claims, and it even influenced later Supreme Court decisions.
Okay, let's talk about that bigger impact. What kind of lasting legacy did Atkins v. Virginia have?
One of the biggest things was that it created this need for specialized legal experts. Lawyers realized that if they were going to handle cases about intellectual disability and the death penalty, they needed to really understand the law, how psychological assessments worked, and the ethics involved. It became a whole new area of expertise.
So it wasn't just about knowing the legal precedents anymore. Lawyers had to understand the science behind intellectual disability, too.
Exactly. And this also had an impact on legal education. Law schools and continuing education courses for lawyers started including Atkins and its implications in their curriculum.
It's like Atkins created a whole new specialty in law.
In a way, it did. And the effects went beyond the legal field, too. The Atkins decision had an impact on later Supreme Court cases, especially Hall v. Florida in 2014.
Right, Hall v. Florida. What was that case about?
Hall had to do with how strictly states could use IQ scores to decide if someone had an intellectual disability. Florida had this rule that anyone with an IQ of 70 or above couldn't be protected by Atkins.
70 seems like a pretty random cutoff point. Did the court have a problem with that?
They did. The Supreme Court said Florida's strict cutoff was unconstitutional. They said that IQ scores aren't perfect and that you have to consider other evidence too, not just the IQ number.
So it was like a refinement of Atkins, basically saying intellectual disability isn't just about one number. It's more complicated than that.
Exactly. Hall made it clear that you have to look at the whole picture, considering all sorts of factors, not just one test score.
It sounds like things are moving towards a more humane and thoughtful approach to justice, at least in this area.
It's definitely a step in the right direction. But these legal battles aren't over. There are still lots of unanswered questions and debates about the death penalty.
Like what? What are some of the things people are still talking about?
Well, one thing is how the Atkins ruling should apply to people with severe mental illnesses, like dementia or traumatic brain injury. These conditions, they don't always fit the definition of intellectual disability, but they can raise the same concerns about culpability and the risk of executing someone who might be innocent.
That's an interesting point. So the idea behind Atkins, that someone's mental state should be considered when deciding if they deserve the death penalty, that could apply to other conditions too.
Exactly. And courts are still figuring out how to handle these complicated issues. It's an area of law that's constantly evolving. There are no simple answers.
So after all this, what stands out to you the most? What's the biggest takeaway from our deep dive into Atkins v. Virginia?
For me, it's realizing that our understanding of justice, it's not fixed. It's always changing, influenced by society, new scientific discoveries, and people who are working hard to make the legal system more humane. Atkins v. Virginia is a great example of how we need to keep questioning our assumptions about punishment, especially when we're talking about the most vulnerable people.
This has been a fascinating look at a landmark case. And to everyone listening, I hope this has made you think, does this idea of evolving standards of decency change how you feel about the role of public opinion in law? And what about how complicated it is to define intellectual disability? Does a single IQ score really tell us everything we need to know? These are the kinds of questions that Atkins v. Virginia makes us think about, and they're going to continue to shape the future of the death penalty in the U.S.